Hi, I'm Author Function.
And I'm Galvin.
And this is the Secret Boss Podcast, where we talk about the best authors in gaming, whether they deserve that title or not. Today, we are talking about a man who has been cursed to the heavens every time they play one of his games. It's Bennett Foddy. Bennett Foddy is a game director who is known for his very, let's say, infuriating games. Would you agree with me there?
Yeah, I would agree with you there. He's been like branded as the kind of guy who like the rage god. Like if everyone had a finger to point at, it would be him.
Yeah, the thing about Foddy's games is that these are often very physics-based games, and a lot of their enjoyment is based on the frustration of its controls and the difficulty in proceeding and getting progress in them.
And kind of like the underlying tones of sadism and like dark humor that underlie a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of comedy in these games where the player is often intentionally being frustrated and failing over and over again because of just how confusing and unintuitive their controls are. Because the controls are something that we usually take for granted in games, where we don't usually think about what we have to do when we're using our controls. But Foddy's games are often completely different, where controls are made in such a way that you're thinking about what they're doing and being confused by the systems that you have to use in order to proceed.
Yeah, I think that's a good starting point. Let's talk about like where he became famous, which is what if a person controlled badly?
What if walking was hard?
It's a real walking simulator, this game. I think he pioneered the concept. Yeah, let's talk about Quap.
Quap was released in 2008. In 2010, it really became popular. All of a sudden, this Flash game comes out of nowhere where you control a track and field runner. You control your thighs and calves based on the controls using the Q, W, O, and P buttons. And that's really all the description the game tells you. Just thighs and calves, use Q, W, O, and P to control. And if you try using that, if you try pressing your fingers to these keys, they're just going to fall over instantly. It doesn't make any sense because that really isn't enough description to what you're doing, right?
Right. It definitely isn't. To this day, even having beaten the game, I can't really tell you what pressing each of the keys does to the body.
Even if you understand the mechanics beneath it, you're not going to be able to control this character efficiently. Like if you're playing Mario, for instance, a regular 2D platformer, just press your right button. You're going to go to the right. But if you're in Quap, you have to do a really strange configuration of buttons to figure out just how to do basic movement, which is really the only object of the game. You just need to complete a 100-meter race, and then you're done with the game, which would be trivial in almost any other control screen. But for Quap, it just doesn't make any sense.
And this ties into the first thing I think I want to talk about with Bennett Foddy's gamography or ludography or whatever you want to call it, which is just like the sense of performance and like sports within his games. Because obviously, if you look at his gamography, there's a lot of sports involved in his games. Quap is a track and field runner. Winner versus Loser is also track and field. Little Master Cricket is cricket. But like, it's the idea that like in a track and field race, you know what you have to do. It's just, there's a difference between knowing what to do and having to actually perform it. You know what you have to do in Quap, but instead of accepting for default that you hold right to run, the game turns the human body into this kind of extremely complicated machine that you have to regulate. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that. And I think sports have a really special and interesting place in Foddy's gamography, because for most video games, they're usually in a speculative fiction area where you're either in a fantasy space or a science fiction area. And if you're in a realist perspective, that's usually in order to tell a serious story. But sports in Foddy's gamography are used in order to get understandable goal for you. You already understand how track and field works. You already have a basic idea for cricket for some people, some demographics.
America, number one country in the world. Who cares about cricket?
Exactly. But people have an understanding of hitting the ball. But the difficulty and failure comes from actually achieving those goals.
Yep. And that's where the comedy comes in also. I feel like, to me, a lot of Foddy's games are like set up in punchline to me. Quap, you load it up. Pretty decent graphics for a Flash game of that age. You know what you have to do just by the presentation alone. You press a button and the guy falls on his face. Honestly, the game could just be that joke. It could just end there. You can only play it once and you would get the whole thing. But of course, another dimension of it is continuing to try and play this extremely busted game and laughing at how you fail.
Right. It's a really interesting way to design a game because it could honestly apply to a large group of demographics. I'm willing to say, big claim here, but Quap is the most widespread popular Flash game ever made. I saw people everywhere just playing this game, even if they didn't play video games in general, because it was a free Flash game that you could instantly play in your browser You didn't need to know how to play video games in order to understand it. And it was funny and interesting.
Right. That's another thing. Fadi talks a little bit in podcasts and talks about how he really believes that accessibility is like the main thing that made Quap blow up. The fact that it wasn't on like a provider site like Kongregate, which was like catering to gamers, the fact that it was on his own site, and the fact that it was very accessible from the level of sports and to other players, that's what made it blow up really well. Let me ask the real important question that's related overall to his gamography. Were you frustrated playing Quap? Actually, did you even beat Quap?
I beat Quap when I was a kid. This is like one of the very first Flash games I played, I'm pretty sure. I remember playing this, and I want to say probably middle school when I first had access to a computer, and it was something that was not blocked on my school's Wi-Fi for whatever reason. Me and my friends, we would just play Quap, and we would just laugh at the really weird interactions we had in the game, and we were also very competitive about it. It was like a social sport.
Oh.
Where we were each trying to get our personal best going as far as we could. I don't think we ever got further than like 20 meters. But it was really engaging to just try and figure out these systems and try to do as good as we can and competing against each other with it.
So it wasn't frustrating for you. It was like fun, even when you failed.
It was frustrating, but it was fun in the way it was frustrating. And as a dumb little kid, it's pretty common for us to try to do something and also laugh at each other for failing at whatever it is. But there's also a sort of community in being able to fail together. Did you ever play Quap?
To be clear, I'm younger than Offer, so I don't have like the whole childhood growing up with Quap experience, but I played it a little bit. I didn't really like it that much. I only beat it last week, when we first started doing this podcast. Hot take? I think it's kind of mid.
You think it's mid? What? Okay, Quap is a very polarizing game. What exactly do you mean when you say Quap is mid?
It's just, I think in the context that I'm doing this podcast, looking through his whole gamography and seeing that one as the one that's been hyped up so much, I feel like even other games like Little Master Cricket do the idea of like having trouble with your body better than Quap does. Maybe it's just because I've been exposed to it too much. Like the way you get sick of like Gangnam Style because people keep playing it.
Well, I am not sick of Gangnam Style and I am not sick of Quap. I am stuck in the year 2012.
Okay, boomer.
Yeah, but I think Quap got its popularity for a reason. I think that it is very instantly understandable and it's very shareable. And basically everyone can have a common experience with this without any differences in video game experience. And it's also like fun in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that applies to a lot of Fadi's other work. And I think for someone who's interested in different and experimental games, that a lot of Fadi's work might be better, but I think that for most people, Quap is going to be a good experience for them.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying personally, playing it single player by myself, I didn't enjoy it. But I'm sure in front of a group, it's definitely more fun. Actually, that reminds me of something else I wanted to bring up with Fadi's work. He talks a lot in talks and podcasts later on after Quap had blew up about wanting to design for spectacle, about wanting to design for playing games in front of like big public spaces. He developed games like Bennett Fadi's Speed Chess for this kind of thing, Get On Top, Multiball.
Yeah, the theme of multiplayer is really consistent through a lot of Fadi's work, which is interesting because it's really some of his least popular games are the competitive multiplayer ones.
Right.
Many of his games, there's two-player co-op, there is winner versus loser, there is Get On Top and Multiball. A lot of these big major games that he worked on are intended for a public space in order to play with multiple other people. But a lot of the ones that get focused on are just his wacky physics-based comedy games for single player.
And don't forget Sports Friends, which was the big game he worked on with three other people and released like, I'm not going to say zero fanfare, but not many people talk about it now. I think the thing that really kills it is that it's local multiplayer. I don't have anyone around me. Many people don't have many people around them anymore in the gaming space. Yeah, it was designed for like these arcades like Baby Castle, like these artistic arcades for people will crowd around and play it. But those are only relegated to like big cities, I think. I wouldn't say many people across the United States have access to that. And local multiplayer is just dying as like a trend.
Yeah, when I was doing research for this episode, I was having a lot of difficulty just finding these games. And of course, they didn't really have a lot of people to play it with right now. And I couldn't, for Multiball, which is one of his major games from a lot of his writing, it seems that I couldn't find any legal way to play this game, but that could just be me.
Well, they said they never legally released the game because there's too many copyright issues.
Oh, interesting. Can you explain a little bit more about multi-bowl and why they had issues with that?
Sure, multi-bowl. This is like a whole separate tangent from everything we've discussed so far. I'm going to need to give a little bit of a preface for multi-bowl. In 2014, Benefati gave this speech called State of the Union at IndieCade East, which was his closing keynote, where he talked about how some developers thought that the indie space was dying because it was fracturing apart and a bunch of corporations were buying out indie people and the indie community just didn't feel that unified. And Fati ended up giving this speech where he gave this extremely expansive history of indie games before 2005, before where most people thought the indie scene started, and gave examples of a bunch of independent creators who made games by themselves and released them by themselves. It was a kind of this long story of persistence. But after doing that speech, Fati talked a lot in talks and podcasts about how he realized that many indie developers were like video game history illiterate. So that's where Multibowl comes in, which is this game he developed with AP Thompson. So it's basically this hack of MAME emulator, which is an emulator that can do a bunch of arcade games and a bunch of console games and a bunch of old computer games. And it's basically this two-player competitive thing where each player has to get the 10 points. Whoever gets the 10 points first wins. Each of the rounds is a 30-second little save state of a different game from throughout history. It ties into the idea of Fati's obsession with like not knowing what the controls are or like having to figure out the controls even though you know them, but it also ties into the example that video game developers can learn a lot from video game history and that history affects us a lot more than we think.
In a lot of Fati's outside texts and articles, he does talk a lot about video game history in ways that it's been ignored. The Amiga is something he's especially interested in, as opposed to the SNES that a lot of American video game players have really thought about, because the experience for a lot of American players is dominant in the Anglosphere, whereas Australia and Brazil and UK, all these different places around the world, aren't as Nintendo focused and played other consoles more often. So there's a lot of video game history and a lot of interesting video games that really get lost in that retro area.
Lots of history that I don't know about also, to be clear. There's this blog post on his blog that's like still good Amiga games that you need to play. And I looked it up and I'm like, I don't know any of these.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean lost to history as in we don't know about these games anymore, but they are not part of the popular discussion in the way that Fati seems to think that they should be.
Well, I mean, lost to history and not part of the discussion have a lot more overlap than maybe you think. I mean, like, it's out of the discussion for me, but also, like, the discussion is so niche that I went on to Backlog, which is how I discover a lot of games. And some of the games that Fati mentioned as classics to him weren't even on Backlog or IGDB, which is the games database that Backlog is based on. So I feel like not discussing it does actually lead to a loss of history. To me, it's just because the gaming scene is so small, a lot smaller than I realized.
Yeah, even the sort of archives that we have of video games really don't have as much as they should. I imagine that most of Fati's games aren't even on something like Backlog or whatever. A lot of them are just little browser games that are made for very specific purposes, not released in a store or whatever. There is a really interesting GDC talk by Bennett Fati where he talks about the importance of game developers putting their name on their game like he often does. Fati's talk in this area that he does with Zach Gage is about the importance of a video game developer crediting themselves and being upfront about the fact that they are making this work. Because a lot of game designers think of themselves as anonymous or they don't want to be a center of attention. And a lot of video game history is like that, right? He really advocates the idea of a game developer being upfront about the fact that they made this game.
Yeah, and he ties this, again, to histories of like big publishing companies erasing the individual names of people who worked on these games as individual developers or small indie studios. And that kind of just led to a precedent of people not crediting themselves, even though those policies are long gone now. Now it just seems like, I don't think Fati says this explicitly in the talk, but I think he's pointing to this kind of idea of this inferiority complex that game developers have in not being able to credit themselves. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that a lot of game developers don't think as highly of their work as they should. And it's sort of a feedback loop, because when you think about authors, think about auteurs and the way that they interact their work and finding connections in between them, you can get a lot of deeper conversation about them and deeper understanding about these games. And that's something that Bennett Fati is talking about himself during this talk. Because like we're doing now, if we think about Bennett Fati as a figure who has lots of these very specific game design decisions, we can think about those decisions on a very deeper level.
And that's what our podcast is about.
Exactly. There is a very good reason to why I personally wanted to do Ben and Fadi for our very first episode. And really, this GDC talk is what made me want to think, like, yes, the auteur is something that is useful for video games, and it's something that we should be talking about, even if it's not a perfect metric or who worked on the games. It's something that is important to discuss and gives us a deeper philosophy for video games.
And I think this is deeply tied to The Big Fish, Getting Over It with Ben and Fadi, 2017.
Yes, Getting Over It is perhaps my favorite video game of all time. I'm not sure if you know this, but...
Wow, really? That I didn't know that.
Yes, Getting Over It is my favorite game, I'm pretty sure. If I had to pick one, it's Getting Over It. I'm wearing my Getting Over It with Bennett Foddy t-shirt right now. I love this game. I got merch for it, and I never get merch, so that means something.
I'm wearing a normal shirt like a normal person. So to explain what Getting Over It with Bennett Foddy is, it's basically this game where you play as a man in a cauldron, and you can't get out of the cauldron, and you move by dragging yourself with a sledgehammer, which you control with the mouse or trackpad. And your goal is to climb this extremely large mountain with only the sledgehammer. If you fall, then the game saves your progress, so you have to start over from wherever you fall from. And throughout the game, Ben Foddy himself is narrating as himself, explaining the game design decisions he makes throughout the game.
And importantly, the way that you're dragging yourself up this mountain has a very video game logic to it. It doesn't really work in any real regular physics. You're able to, for example, pogo stick your way, where you're slamming your sledgehammer just straight into the ground, and you go flying up in the air. It's a very silly and unrealistic physics engine, but it's a lot of fun to try and figure out where the breaks in reality are and where you're able to find your own space and creativity and way of expressing yourself within the game while progressing.
Yeah, I think it also has that kind of like set of punchline comedy in it also. Like in earlier on in the game, you find this coffee cup that's like a loose coffee cup and you fling it down and you're like, huh, that's weird. What's that all about? And then like a quarter into the game, the mountain just kind of stops and it becomes like a mountain of like trash and like Unity assets cobbled together into like 2D platforms that float above the air. So halfway through the game, all the realism just kind of stops and Buddy's just like, yeah, fuck you. Just start climbing this now.
A common theme in this game is that use of trash and reusing assets to make something new and interesting. And during this time, he talks about how he doesn't think very highly about asset reuse and the digital information that is just stored away on the internet. But I think that reusing stuff that wasn't meant to be used in this specific context really adds to the work. It makes it more interesting and it gives it a deeper dimension to it that I think a lot of conversations about asset reuse and the simplicity of video games sometimes really miss, because this is a very personal, thoughtful essay of a game. It's a rare example of an essay game where the creator is directly commenting on the game as you play it.
Yeah, and I think that like direct self-insertion really introduced a lot of people, like people who watch Let's Plays, people who didn't even play the game, to the idea. Well, it didn't introduce them, they already knew, but like it reminded them of the idea that humans make video games. And that kind of ties into what Ben and Fadi said about his inspiration for making the game. He was talking about how he made the game as a response to Gamergate and how a lot of people were like abusing devs. It seemed like they didn't remember them as people.
That's very interesting, because in Getting Over, there's a very purposeful way of trying to get the player to empathize and think of the developer as a person. He talks about the way that he is designing the game. He talks about his own personal thoughts on games and culture. And also, formally, he interjects himself when you make progress, when you fail, and the microphone quality gets worse and worse as you go up, and it feels more and more like he's closing into the microphone, talking specifically to you in a unfiltered, unprofessional way.
But like legitimately, one of the most hurtful parts of the game is, to me, when after you fall so many times, he goes, I'm just going to give you a bit to collect your thoughts. And he goes away and he never comments again until you progress. So after that, when you fall, there's just silence. And to me, that was like one of the most harsh parts of the game. There was just like a void, because Ben and Fadi was kind of getting on my nerves earlier. But like once he's gone, you feel that absence.
I first played this game when it came out to the Humble Bundle service. And I remember it took me a very long time to play. I beat it in about 12 hours. And I must have exhausted all that dialogue. And I remember having a very personal relationship, being very angry at this game. Oh my God, I hate this, but I need to finish it. Whereas now, I've played this over 50 times, and every time you beat the game, your cauldron gets more and more gold. So I have a completely golden cauldron now. And I just played this game in a way it's very relaxing. It feels like a comforting area to me. It feels comforting to fail. It feels comforting to make progress. It feels comforting to hear his voice and to be in this space. So it's no longer a place of frustration for me, but it's a place for me to feel comfort in knowing that I was once frustrated. And it really makes me feel like I got over it. I got over my failures. I got over this mountain. And now it's just a place where I can relax and have fun. It takes 20 minutes for me to beat this game now, less than 20 minutes. And I love it more and more every time.
Let's dig into this, because we haven't really talked about our personal feelings on a specific game. Like for me personally, I was pissed off at the beginning of this game. I played it first a year and a half ago. I knew about it. I'd seen playthroughs of it, but my friend had beaten this game like 50 times, and he said this game changed his life. And he recommended it to me, and I was like, okay, you know what? I haven't actually sat down and played it. I played it. I got to one specific part, which is, you know it when you see it. It's a part that involves two lanterns, and I couldn't get past it. And I was just so frustrated that I just put it down and I seethed over it until we did this podcast. I picked it back up again, like dreading it. I remember I wrote down my feelings because I was taking this. I wrote down, this game genuinely had like a physical reaction. The middle of my spine was getting tense because I was leaning forward so much. My feet were poised at the legs of my chair, just like tensed and like never relaxed, constantly off the floor. I was like in pain doing it. And then I managed to get up the lantern part once. And that's when I realized, oh, I can actually do this. Two things happened. One thing is I immediately became a lot calmer. And the second thing is I got addicted to it. Because like before, I was not addicted to this game at all because I thought I couldn't do it. But the second I realized I could climb something, I became obsessed with the idea of constantly coming back and trying again, even when I stopped playing. Do you think you had a similar experience to that?
Yeah, I think that is the common experience. I think it's the intended experience. And specifically the experience that I had. Because just going up against this wall and trying your hardest to get back up every single time, it just feels so intensely frustrating, but also very doable that it becomes addicting in a way. And this game became incredibly popular, maybe even more popular than Co-op in gaming circles specifically. It became one of the top streaming games. And for a while, it was the top game on Steam because the appeal is so obvious and specific that there's really nothing else like it. And it becomes interesting to watch as the sort of spectator sport to see a streamer just scream all over all their failures and trying their hardest to get up this mountain. It becomes its own narrative in a way of failing at first and then becoming better through your own determination and trying as hard as you can. It's really a perfect game for the broader gaming media sphere.
And the game gets to a point where when you keep falling down, at some point it just doesn't even matter, right? Because like at that point, you've just like practiced the earlier parts so much that you can get back to where you were in maybe like 5 to 10 minutes. Falling from the middle to the bottom of the screen actually isn't that big of a punishment once you get really good at the game. Point where I can like press new game and I wouldn't actually be losing anything.
Right. And part of what makes this game so emotionally powerful for a lot of people is feeling that feeling of failure in your own life in some other area and like feeling that there's no way of getting back up and doing it again. Whereas this game encapsulates that in a very small enclosed area where you fail and it feels horrible and frustrating, but getting back up really isn't as bad as doing it the first time if you get over that initial emotional reaction.
Yeah, and there's no like narrative connection to it either. You literally are the main character and your task is playing this game. There's no underlying narrative behind it.
I mean, I do think that is the case for every game. I think the main character of nearly every game is the player in a sort of distances area, but I understand what you mean, where the focus is not on the character in the cauldron. The focus is on you, and Fadi is speaking to you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, Portal 2 is centered on GLaDOS at some point. GLaDOS becomes more important than you. But here, you're the center of it. Or you can say Bennett Fadi, but he comes in and out. I think it's mainly you that he is reacting to. This game's like really popular with streamers, and I think it's an evolution of that public space we were talking about before, because like he was talking about trying to design games for public arcades like Mega GURP and like Bennett Foddy Speed Chess. But now you have this public space, but it's completely online. There's one person and there's thousands of people. They're not in the same physical space as a streamer, but they're commenting on it, and it becomes this whole kind of thing that everyone's crowded around watching.
That's an interesting perspective. I think that you're right here, I think the social space has changed so much that trying to recreate that feeling of a multiplayer experience through something like Multibowl, that is valuable and it has its own place. And I'm glad that it happened. But I also think that that has largely been replaced on a broader social scale. Something like Getting Over It. We're able to share some specific interesting moment and bring it to a whole audience that you may not personally know. But the multiplayer gaming of today is through these social spaces, through streaming, through community playthroughs, and so on.
Another thing Fadi talks about a lot is that players deep down, they want frustration. They want friction because when they get that relief, that catharsis, it's a lot more satisfying.
Right. I think that Fadi consistently talks about how surprised he is that his games are popular. And it becomes clear that he is not as much of a minority within the gaming space as he thinks he is. And that there is a large group of people who think in the same way as he does, where frustration is fun and trying to figure out strange systems is fun. And that it's valuable to be reaching out to these people. It makes Fadi a very interesting figure and different figure from the rest of the gaming space because he positions himself as opposed to most of it. And formally, a lot of his work is opposed to most conventional game design. That is what makes the relationship between the player and him such an interesting one because it is developed from seeing something that is alien to the rest of the gaming industry and trying to create a figure that encapsulates those different feelings and trying to understand where those different feelings came from.
Are you saying the people created him as the idea of a gaming auteur?
Yeah. Well, people, of course, did not create Bennett Fadi. But Fadi as a name, as a figure within our social discourse, is something that was created from people's frustrations with his game specifically and trying to seek out who made it and trying to have a figure that they can yell at, someone that they can get mad at and understand who they are blaming for why this game is bad. If you think of a lot of other games that people are frustrated with or think are uninteresting, if people are mad at, say, Mass Effect Andromeda, that is bad and frustrating in a way that is recognizable. It's buggy, it's uninteresting in its story, whereas Bennett Fadi's games are frustrating in a way that makes you have to wonder, who made this? Why did someone design this in such a purposeful way? And that makes people seek out who Bennett Fadi is and try to understand his games and why they're different. And this is another big claim I want to make. I want to say that Bennett Fadi is one of the very few game developers whose name you can say, and the average gamer will stand that name as a certain kind of game design. Not narrative, not like tone or setting, but a specific kind of game design. I think you can say a Fadi-like to someone and they'll understand what you mean.
That's really true. Yeah, I've seen the term Fadi used in a bunch of articles I looked through this week. It's funny to me because this is like the same way people say like Hitchcockian or Kubrickian or Lynchian or whatever. The name denotes a style. I think we're both talking about this in the very post-Getting Over It world, where Fadi really hoisted himself up as a gaming auteur. Not to promote himself. To me, he made Getting Over It more in conjunction with the idea that you put your name on your game. People saw that example of him putting his name in Getting Over It and just kind of like hoisted him up immediately.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I think that if he did not market himself, not marketing in a money-based way, but if he did not put his name on his game and make himself a figure of his game, people would not have sought him out on their own.
This is something he encourages people to do, by the way, because he says that while people abusing game developers is obviously the people's fault, he also thinks that game designers should take more responsibility in promoting themselves and putting their presence in games. So he is a very pro-auteurist kind of person in that sense. The responsibility of a game designer also ties into the idea that he's promoting called a disobedient game, which is a game that directly talks back to the player and responds to the player as if a person is behind the controls. Like the example he uses in an interview is Hurt Me Plenty by Robert Yang, which is meant to be like a public space installation where you basically spank a guy by flicking your mouse. The game opens with this kind of BDSM request where you move your mouse up and down to shake hands with the person while they make these kind of specifications for what they want. Like, I want this gentle treatment with these specific clothes. And he gives you a safe word also. So basically, once you agree with that, you can do whatever you want. And when he says the safe word, you can, in fact, keep going. Basically, if you keep going after the safe word and keep spanking him, he collapses. And then afterwards, he tells you that he felt really violated by your advances and that he needs some time off to get away from this all. And then the game fades and starts over and says, hey, just letting you know, a guy used by the previous players so much that he needs some time to recover. He will be back in 8 days. And there's actually a real-time counter that's counting down from 8 days until you're available to play the game again. That's a disobedient game to Bennett Foddy, you know. A game that's like, yeah, sure, technically you can do this, but I, the game designer, have some say in what you do. And like, it's like you're communicating with a person because a person did make this game. Okay, random question, Offer. Did you notice anything about music or rhythm in this game, in his games, in Foddy's games?
Going across his gamography and seeing all the connections between Quap and Multibowl and getting over to Bennett Foddy, I have to say, I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. I see no music in these games in any important way.
No rhythm or anything either?
I ain't got rhythm.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to bring this up because I was looking a lot at the things he was doing before being a game dev. So a little bit of history. He started game dev at, I think, around age 33. He wasn't doing that when he was starting out. He got a PhD in philosophy, I think philosophy of science. There's also, tying back to the sports thing if you want to, there's also a very funny scientific article he wrote about how it would be cool if we put enhancement drugs in athletes just to see how far they would go, basically. I think he loves the idea of pushing bodies, human bodies, to the limit. But the reason I bring up music is because he also had a side gig as the bassist for a band called Cut Copy, who would later go on to win a bunch of Grammys after he left. And some interviews mentioned this. I think rhythm has some part in his games, I think. Not a huge role, but in a way that ties into like the physics of the whole thing. For example, Little Master Cricket, the balls are, Little Master Cricket is a little cricket game where you control your bat with a mouse and you're kind of floppy guy. And the balls are served to you with this specific rhythm. And I really do think you do better when you hit it with a specific like rhythm and intent every time the ball is thrown. Other examples are Quap and Clop. If you begin running in at a fast enough speed, steadily, music's coming in. Flop also has a little bit of music, and Getting Over has a bit of music that progress you fail. And I would say the biggest thing that really impressed me was his sleeper hit, which I'm going to recommend later on, Winner versus Loser, which is not physics-based at all. It's actually kind of like timing-based. It's basically this one-button game where you play against another person, or you're supposed to. And you're running while jumping over hurdles. You press the button at a specific speed, a specific rhythm to run. You run forward every time you, but if you press the button too fast, then you fall. And you have to hold down the button if you jump over, like long before the hurdles. So you have to run. So it gets like into a really interesting balancing situation. Balance, like running fast enough that you beat your, slow enough you don't, and also that you have enough time to jump over the hurdle. And it becomes, yeah, very rhythm-based. And in a way where I even saw the track, like the side track view as like as a music chart. I don't know. Did you see any of that? Or do you not have any idea what I'm talking about?
This is where we differ in our play styles, Galvin. Because when I played Winner versus Loser, I mashed that button over and over again. And that's how I got my best time. Do you want to go into the recommendations?
Yes.
I think that Getting Over It is really his greatest work. I think that is a coda for the rest of his work. If you play Getting Over It, you'll have a deeper understanding of all of his other games as well.
Yeah, I would agree. If you play one game from the games we talked about, or even his whole gamography, I would say Getting Over It.
I will say Quap is good to play for a couple of minutes, but GURP was a standout for me. You had to press specific keys in order to progress. And it makes your hands go in really weird, awkward positions, trying to reach over to the other keys. And it feels very physical in a way that almost every other game I play just does not hit for me.
Also worth checking out is a Mega GURP, which is an installation he made with Doug Wilson, which is just a larger version of that on like Twister mats. You can't play it anymore, but it's a very funny idea.
Interesting. Was this like a museum exhibition or something?
Artistic arcade exhibition, basically, like we discussed before, yeah. If I were to recommend a second game, it would be Multibowl, because I would say Getting Over covers a lot of bases of Foddy's general, the common threads in Foddy's gamography, but Multiple covers his whole video game history obsession, which I think is a very separate thing. It's just really interesting to play, and also watch the talk that he gave, the 2014 State of the Union. The other two games I recommend are Little Master Cricket and Luna vs. Loser, which I think are sleeper hits in this collection. I liked GURP a little bit, but I don't know, I'm a contrarian at heart, so I think you should play those. Don't forget the most important game in his gamography, Pac-In. You do me a favor, just pause the podcast right now, just download it. It's on our research page. I'm talking to the listener, not you, Oliver. You don't have to do it. Okay, you're back. Wasn't that amazing? Oliver doesn't get it. Okay, let's move on. I would say the talks that are important, go listen to Put Your Name on Your Game, because that's one of his most important talks, especially in terms of game auteurism. I would also say No Pain, No Game is a great way to get to know his whole pain philosophy. And I recommend Making It Matter, Lessons from Real Sports.
Yeah, Fadi has a lot of great external stuff. I recommend his blog. And I do want to circle back to the GDC talk about putting your name on this game. That is a fantastic talk. It's probably one of my favorite GDC talks. And I do truly recommend that as well. I also want to recommend the Why We Should Allow Performance Enhancing Drugs in Sport. I don't think that this has anything to do with game design or any of his games, but I find it very funny and very interesting, but it's also like very genuine. And this paper has over 500 citations, which is a very high amount for a philosophy paper to have.
The people demand performance-enhancing drugs. Everyone loves it. Also, if you want game recommendations from him, he actually runs a secret game recommendations blog. That's not dot fun. He writes it himself. He didn't link it on his main page like an asshole, but he wrote like 7 or 8 game recommendation blog posts that I think are really well written. Other things, I guess, I mean, I've highlighted a bunch of the stuff I like on the research document, which is included in the description of this episode. So just go check it out if you want. He's a really interesting guy. Any final thoughts?
First you, Bennett Foddy.
Yeah, fuck know. You. Never come onto our podcast.
Wow, you just really ran that up. Right, so at the end of these episodes, we're going to be announcing the next auteur that we're going to be covering. And because I picked Bennett Foddy, Galvin is getting to pick the next one. So Galvin, what did you pick for us?
I am recommending to you Jay Folan. Actually, do you know anything about Jay Folan? You tell me first.
I do not. I have not heard this name before. I mean, I have heard this name before. You have mentioned it to me, but I do not remember him.
Well, he was most famous for making Hypno Space Outlaw. He designed it and wrote it, but he also made a game called Dropsy. Both of those games were funded through Kickstarter. They're both adventure games. He also made a spin-off to Hypno Space Outlaw called Slayer's X, Vengeance of the Slayer. His games are adventure games that are underlined with very, I would say, humanist Christian philosophy, because that's one thing he makes very clear. He is a Protestant Christian. If I were to recommend something to you, I want you to beat Hypno Space Outlaw. That's the most important part to me. And if you want to, also play Dropsy and maybe Player's X or whatever. That's what I think.
Yes, I'm excited into getting over Bennett Foddy and moving on to our next director. So thank you for that recommendation.
Please don't tell me we're going to do that every episode. I can't wait to Hypno Space away from Jay Folan onto the next episode.
I can't wait to drop See My Way into Shigeru Miyamoto.
That's good. You. And as always, I'm Galvin.
And I'm Awful Function. Thank you for listening.